Great pleasure that I give you Dr. Ilya Delio.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. Can you all hear me in the back?
Yes.
Well, I come at the end of a long day and some really wonderful papers, so it's going to be a hard act to follow Father Scanlon here, but my story is a little bit different, maybe a little bit more focused on the meaning of Christ in evolution. Let me begin by saying that, you know, Christianity didn't drop down from the heavens. That it emerged, you might say, in what Carl Jaspers called the axial age of consciousness, an age where the human person as person emerged as autonomous, free, and transcendent. In fact, all the world religions emerged within this broad period of time. Judaism, Islam, Christianity. And maybe what is significant about the emergence of religion in the axial period and the human person as person is that the consciousness of God was framed against an understanding of the cosmos. So we have an articulation emerging in this period between cosmology and theology. In other words, how we understand the divine formed against how we understand the cosmos. So when the psalmist wrote, you know, when I look at the heavens and the moon and the stars which you arranged, it was a looking up, you know, to the sky and a universe that was considered to be a three-tiered universe. That kind of formation of cosmology, especially, and here's what's important for us to note, a stable, fixed cosmos is where most of the world religions have been formed out of. And that includes Christianity. In the Middle Ages, theology was known as the queen of sciences because all knowledge was to lead to God. In the medieval cosmos, which was the Ptolemaic cosmos, that beautiful, stable, orderly, hierarchical, fixed cosmos, in which the earth was center, and the sun and the planets orbited around the earth, the human person was center of the universe. And creation itself bore the footprints of God, because God was the ordainer, the creator of the whole, and therefore creation reflected that divine creator, and the human person was the reader of the book of nature, the one who would, like Francis of Assisi, you know, go about the beautiful things of creation and see beauty itself written on the things of nature. The influence of Greek philosophy, as Father Scanlon was saying, on Christian theology is paramount, and it peaked, you might say, in the Middle Ages, where Thomas brought together, you might say, the best of Aristotelian philosophy with Christian doctrine and formed a wonderful synthesis. But both, I think we have to remember that both Thomas and Bonaventure didn't just study scripture and theology. They also studied arithmetic and physics, and they studied what was the world of their day. And, you know, out of that study, they came to an understanding of God and the human person and the cosmos itself. And what they understood in their time was that in this fixed, stable cosmos, in this fixed, stable universe, the human person bore a special relatedness to God as center of the universe. After the Middle Ages, after the High Middle Ages, and especially in the 14th and 15th centuries, there was the discovery of heliocentrism. And that's where, you know, someone like Nicholas Copernicus, gazing up at the stars, you know, said, I don't think we are center and stable. I think we might be moving. And, of course, he was very neurotic about that and didn't quite put his findings out there right away. But indeed, the idea of a heliocentric universe came to be confirmed and perhaps best articulated by Galileo in his Dialogue of the Two World Great World Systems. This created really sort of a rift, you might say, between what we call today science and religion. Many of, up to this age, there were many proto-scientists, we can say, who were very religious men, and the whole purpose of science was really to give God glory. But once heliocentrism became more and more the dominating paradigm of how the cosmos is organized, the church was not ready, you might say, for the major upheaval of a moving earth. After all, the story was framed around a fixed earth in a fixed cosmos. So if the earth is moving around the sun, and the human person is no longer the center of the earth, but just part of a spinning planet, how then could we understand the Genesis account of, say, being formed in the image of God? Or how would we understand sin and salvation if the earth is moving? So what we're saying is, a lot of Christian doctrine, no, really all of it, was formed within the cosmology of a fixed, stable structure. Galileo argued that the Bible and the natural world both come from God and are meant to be in harmony. As Cardinal Baronius remarked, the Bible teaches how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Well, be that as it may, Galileo spent most of his life under house arrest. But once the theory of heliocentrism became more and more the law of the planets, we can say that the church found itself in a more vulnerable position with regard to science. We know that the church was always the patron of the sciences. That is true. But it did not really accept heliocentrism as the dominant paradigm of the cosmos. We can couple then the rise of modern science with, you might say, the Protestant Reformation and its emphasis on sin and salvation. And the result is a disconnection of the human person from the created world, from the world of nature itself. We might say, certainly after the Reformation, there is a growing emphasis on the individual, detached from the world of nature. Similarly, science grew detached from its Christian roots and developed more as a self-sufficient discipline, a self-explanatory means of explaining natural events. It took someone like Descartes, who was a Jesuit-trained philosopher, to really take note that a problem of God was emerging. You know, it was all well and good up to the Middle Ages, and that's why I think we're always attracted to medieval theology, because it has with it this synthesis of God, creation, and the human person. Descartes really worried, you know, he was a bit of neurotic himself, you know, how do we preserve God from the clutches of a changing world? So up to the rise of modern science, we could find God in the world of nature. Now, with the rise of heliocentrism and the spinning earth, there was no certainty of God in nature. So Descartes said, well, I know, we'll place that certainty of God in the thinking person. So his famous, you know, I think, therefore I am, became at the same time a radical detachment from the world of nature itself. So we can say that nature was stripped, you might say, of a sacred character. And certainly if you read any of the scientific journals of that time, in other words, brute matter can be done, do with it whatever you want to. And so knowledge of God becomes then focused on the individual. That also it places, you might say, this turn to the subject with Descartes also became a means of, where will we find the point of unity? Again, in the Middle Ages, God, you know, as the creator of all, was the source of unity. After Descartes, that source of unity becomes located in the individual. And so this the scientific worldview, this change in from a geocentric to a heliocentric world, really threw the God of Jesus Christ into doubt and disbelief. I think the transition of knowledge from object or from the microcosm to subject imposed a burden on the human person to make sense of the world by rational thought alone. In the ancient world, the human person had a purpose. As image of God, we were to create, and rather to unite heaven and earth. But in the modern world, The human person seemed to be subsumed into the dazzling world of scientific data. More and more, we have lost our place, you might say, in the cosmos, lost in space. Do you remember that program? And, you know, even today, I always say we have really become data points. You know, when people, it's no longer the identity of the human person has been, in a sense, subsumed by a scientific world. All you have to do is call your public utility company to find that out. Then we come to the world of Newton. You know, in Newton's world, I always say Newton had the Florida God, because it was this God, you know, who gave rise to all that is, the omnipotent God who governed the world from above. So God put it all into motion. The world ran like a machine. God, you might say, retired to Florida and checked in, called the grandkids, you might say, every once in a while to see how things were doing. But Newton's world was a world of law and order, you know, and God would just come in and tune it up when things were running down. Interestingly, though, we began to structure our lives according to Newton's world. Barbara Taylor Brown, in a little book called The Luminous Web, says, "Believing that Newton told us the truth about how the world works, we modeled our institutions on atomistic principles. You are you, and I am I. If each of us will do our parts, then the big machine should keep on humming." She says, "Our God view came to resemble our world view. Even in this century, even much of our practical theology has become mechanical and atomistic. Walk into many churches and you will hear God described as a being who behaves almost as predictably as Newton's universe. Say you believe in God and you will be saved. If you sin, you will not be saved. Sin against God and you will be condemned. Say you are sorry and you will be forgiven. Obey the law and you will be blessed." And I do think that idea of Newton's mechanistic universe, in other words, has really infiltrated the way we think about even our religious lives, our lives in God, our lives as church, our lives as a people of faith. We can say that as the cosmos, as our understanding of the cosmic order assumed a new world picture through modern science, Christianity and religion at large remained tied to the medieval cosmos. Christian doctrine was inscribed within the framework of a perfect, immutable, hierarchical, and anthropocentric order. And it still is. And it was within this order that Anselm's satisfaction theory was framed. Namely, the reason for Jesus Christ was to repay the sin incurred by Adam and Eve. I think to really understand, or really to grapple with, the meaning of Jesus Christ in the world that we now live in, we do need to just mention the world in which we live in. Theology is integrally related to cosmology, because the name God, as we heard already today, points to the being of beings. It's the ground. God is that which no greater can be thought, thanks to Anselm, but the being of everything that exists. And therefore, I think we have to realize that the most fundamental shift in our understanding of the cosmos is the move from a vision of a universe launched in its present form by the hand of God at the beginning of time to a vision of the cosmos as dynamic, unfolding, immensely large in time and space. Certainly, as we heard this morning from Dr. Barr, the new science of the 20th century has ushered in a very new view of the cosmos that continues to unfold through scientific discovery. We know today that our universe, the ones we are occupying in, our home, is about 13.7 billion years old. With a future of billion of years before us. Now, being 13.7 billion years old, as one astronomer has indicated, implies that it is 13.7 billion light years in radius from where we are. Now, can you get your heads around 13.7 billion light years? Some scientists estimate that the future age of the universe, the long age, I mean, this is the cold, dark death that's anticipated, about 100 trillion years. Now, the sun will probably die out in about 9 billion years. Now, you're worried about what's going to happen tomorrow or next year with the Pope, you know. In other words, we're here for 70 years or 80 if you're strong, the psalmist once said. We're here for a very, very short time in an immensely large universe. And again, that could make, are we insignificant or are we immensely significant? Where do we stand in this immense cosmos? As we heard this morning, some scientists suggest that our universe may be one of many universes that occupy space. What we can say is our own galaxy, the Milky Way, consists of hundreds of billions of stars and stretches about 100,000 light years in diameter. And these galaxies, these groups of stars, are often grouped into clusters. We're just cosmically communal, and that's why I think we're really Franciscan at the heart of the cosmos. When you even look, again, time span, I mean, the first formation of stars is about 400 million years after the Big Bang. The sense of time and deep time in the cosmos for life to form has not yet penetrated our thinking. But what we do know today is that the two main pillars of modern science are evolution and quantum physics, two broad main pillars. Evolution, very succinctly, does not mean that your nearest relative is a monkey. In other words, evolution points to the fact that it's not quite a mechanistic universe on all aspects of the way life unfolds. That life unfolds, for the most part, as a process. A process that involves chance, law, and deep time, the interplay of these. So evolution means that life unfolds from simple to more complex being. It doesn't mean that things necessarily get better. As someone said, oh, evolution means things get better. No, things get more complex. And by complexity, we mean degrees of relatedness. As we move from single cells to more complex entities, they unite, they converge, and as they converge, something new forms. You know, hydrogen and oxygen, they come together, they form water. And so that newness is part of evolution itself. A lot of my work these past few years has been with the Jesuit scientist priest Teilhard de Chardin, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who was a renowned paleontologist and spent most of his life trying to bring together evolution and Christianity. Teilhard described evolution as a biological ascent, a movement toward more complexified life forms, which at critical points, qualitative differences emerge. So why I bring Teilhard up is because, not because I'm working with Jesuits and I'm mandated to do so, but he was an original thinker as scientist and as a believer. And what he saw was a compatibility, not only a compatibility, but a confluence, you might say, between evolution and Christianity. What he said is evolution is not merely an explanation of physical life. Rather, he said, it has ushered in a whole new Weltanschauung, a whole new worldview that affects every aspect of created life. Evolution, he said, is neither theory nor particular fact, but a dimension to which all thinking in whatever area must conform. And if you are familiar with Carter Phipps' book that came out last year titled Evolutionaries, Carter Phipps speaks about evolution on all different aspects of life today, not only the sciences, but culture, economics, etc. In this respect, what makes the world in which we live specifically modern, what distinguishes it from past worlds, is evolution. It's a word that defines almost all of science, certainly on the biological, chemical, and many aspects of the physical level, as a history of systems. Again, evolution means nature does not operate only according to fixed law, but to the dynamic interplay of law, chance, and deep time. In 1940, Teilhard completed perhaps his most important work, now translated as The Human Phenomenon, but the old translation is The Phenomenon of Man. In this book, which he wrote in China, he described the fourfold sequence of the evolution of galaxies, Earth, life, and consciousness. So he describes this sort of unfolding from cosmogenesis to biogenesis. And this is what he says: the human person is not a ready-made fact, but the outflow of billions of years of evolution. That point alone has not entered into our thinking. A few years ago, I was having supper with a lovely young woman, and she said, "Well, what are you doing these days?" And I said, "Well, I'm working on evolution in Christianity." And she said, "Oh," she said, "well, evolution is just a theory." I said, "Yes, but I mean, most of science now runs according. I mean, this is not a theory for scientists." She said, "Oh, no," she said, "God created us fully formed and planted us on Earth." I said, no, I said, "That was a story, you know, for its time." "No," she said, "it's true. God created Adam and Eve and put them on Earth, and we're descendants of Adam and Eve." I said, "It's really been nice knowing you this evening." It is an amazingly fine-tuned universe, as we heard this morning, the anthropic coincidences of this universe. But what we have to realize is the embodied persons that we are have a long history. All the constituents that have come together to form our own physical being were present in the Big Bang, or as you know, some say, we are stardust. That's not a new agey idea. That's, in a sense, what science is showing us. To realize that we humans are part of a larger process, which involves long spans of developmental time, brings a massive change to all of our knowledge and our beliefs. We are not simply products of evolution. And here's one of Teilhard's major insights. We are not simply the products of evolution. We are evolution come to consciousness. And therefore, while we are no longer center of the universe, as the medievals held, we are now the arrow. We are, in a sense, the conscious self-reflection of this universe, which means the way we think, the way we choose, and the way we orient our lives will make a difference to the future. So evolution does change the way I think we understand Christianity and the phenomenon of religion itself. We have to admit that Christianity is not, in a sense, some isolated religious phenomenon. It emerges as part of a larger cosmic religious phenomenon. It did not arise de novo or out of nothing, so to speak, but arose out of an evolution of consciousness along with the other world religions. If we continue to see Christianity as just separate and exclusive from a larger whole, then we risk losing its illuminative value. As Teilhard wrote, "Our Christology," he said, "is still expressed in exactly the same terms as though which 3 centuries ago could satisfy those whose outlook on the cosmos it is now physically impossible for us to accept. What we have to now do without delay is to modify the position occupied by the central core of Christianity, and this precisely in order that it may not lose its illuminative value." Or my shorthand term is, every age must discover Christ anew. There is no fixed Christ that will just, you know, as an abstract concept. So that brings us then to what do we mean by Jesus as the Christ? And let me just, you know, underscore here that Jesus is the Christ, right? I think Terry will, and those of you who teach theology, Christ is not Jesus' surname, you know, like he was the son of Mr. and Mrs. Christ. which in some ways we have fallen into that trap, you know, that we have made Jesus into a really good person, but not as the Christ. So how do we understand the Christ? And how do we understand the Christ in the context of an evolutionary cosmology? Well, I think there, you know, if we look maybe at the broad sweep of things, we can understand a personal God in a personalizing universe, both historically and cosmologically. In a sense, the West has focused on the historical, and that is on the human history, of God in the person of Jesus, on the context of his life, and on community. The cosmological perspective, which is more typical of Eastern theology, has sought to understand Christ within the larger context of reality, the whole, you might say, the cosmic whole. I might, further parcel these into two ways of the way we've understood Christ is the satisfaction theory, focusing on the history of human sin, and the primacy of Christ tradition, focusing on God as love. Let me just take a minute with those. We're coming up to Easter soon, and in that Easter celebration, we'll sing the Exalted. We will sing, "O Felix Culpa, O happy fault, for if Adam had not sinned, Christ would not have come. Yay to sin," right? So we'll say, we are so thankful that Adam and Eve had sin, because if they didn't sin, we wouldn't have Christ. Now, I know we do this year after year, and so it's ingrained in our consciousness, But what we have done is, through the satisfaction theory, we have made sin the priority over love. So what we're saying is there was a perfect creation, and there was a defect incurred in that creation, in which then there was a need for satisfaction of that defect of sin. So you might say this is sort of a rescue theology or a rescue Christology. God had to send the Son, or only one equal to God could repay the debt due to God. Now, there have been thinkers throughout the ages who said, really? I mean, we're saying that the incarnation, Word made flesh, is due to a defect in creation. How could something so awesome be due to a negative? Or as my friend Bill Short would say, why build the Taj Mahal to cover a pothole? Why would God do something so incredibly immense for something that, is... Now, this doesn't negate sin. Believe me, you only have to wake up in the morning to know that sin is real and it exists. The difference is this. The way I see it is that the satisfaction theory focuses, it's anthropological. It focuses on the human person as a sinner. The primacy of Christ tradition focuses on love and God as love. And we can look from Irenaeus through Hugh of St. Victor to Rupert of Deutz, all through the history of theology. We find theologians say, God is love. From all eternity, God has willed to love and to share God's love in a personal way and with a finite other. So from all eternity, Christ has been, or in the mind of God, Christ has been willed by God. Of course, it took a Franciscan, Duns Scotus, to make this doctrine more explicit. And Scotus said that love and not sin is the reason for the incarnation. Scotus looked at the large picture and not the narrow picture of sin. And he saw this intimate relationship between creation and incarnation. The God who is creative and in love is the God who shares God's life with another. So, or as Karl Rahner would say, creation and incarnation are two aspects of the same act of God's self-giving love. So love, Scotus said, is the reason for everything that exists, including the Christ. God wanted to express God's self outwardly in a creature who would be a masterpiece and love God perfectly in return. So Scotus's doctrine of the primacy of Christ means that Christ is first in God's intention to love, and therefore God's intention to create. Which means creation is not an independent act of divine love, and like, oh, I think I'll create here. Oh, they got it wrong. I'll have to, send the Son whom I love. So it's not followed up by divine self-revelation. Rather, the divine desire to become incarnate was part of the divine plan from all eternity. As the author of the letter of the Colossians writes, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. So Christ is the summum opus Dei, the work of art. And by that I understand that creation is centered on incarnation. Every act of creation, every
every blip on the screen, you might say, of the Big Bang cosmos. Every quark, every lepton, every hadron, every leaf, cloud, fruit. Everything is the outward expression of the Word of God in love. So that when Jesus comes, you might say, there is a perfect fit because everything has been made to resemble Christ. Sun, moon, trees, animals, stars, all have life in Christ. Christ is that personal word of love incarnate, and therefore the motif or the pattern of creation. The perfect, you might say, divine, human, cosmic communion, which exemplifies the meaning and purpose of all creation. All this evolutionary cosmos, according to the primacy of Christ, is, might say, made for unity in love. Now, the emphasis on love did, you might say, obscure the reason for Christ, rather the emphasis on sin, and the church fathers did hold many councils. They had lots of meetings in those days. Some things have never changed, but and it was really to define the natures of Christ, true God and true man, you know, and it was really against Arianism to really affirm that Jesus is truly God, you know, and not just like God or son of God, but truly Jesus Christ is one person subsisting in two natures, divine and human. But this definition of Chalcedon is based on a Greek understanding of person and nature, something that Mike Scanlon was getting at in his talk. Since the 5th century, Christian orthodoxy has maintained that divine and human natures are fully unified in Jesus, a oneness of person subsisting in two natures. I know, does that, you know, wake you up in the morning? It's a good definition, I guess, to say that what, you know, breaks through in Jesus is truly God. There was a disagreement over, you know, the exact incarnational union. The Antiochians stressed the humanity of Jesus, the Alexandrians stressed the divinity of Christ. But, you know, to make a long story short, what are we talking about here? You know, when we talk about nature, human nature, divine nature, divine nature is even more difficult. I mean, I take that as divine nature. It's the mystery of God. Human nature is becoming more complex today through neuroscience, through genetics, through the, you know, if we think we know what we're talking about, wow, then you'll win the Nobel Prize very soon. So when we talk about human personhood in an evolving cosmos, these questions are not easily answered without engaging modern physics and biology. If you want to throw in the mix, Teilhard spoke of a third nature of Christ. He said we can no longer talk about Jesus Christ in an evolving cosmos without including the cosmic nature of Christ, if indeed evolution is, you might say, the unfolding of Christ. So it's not just divine human, but it's divine human cosmic for Teilhard. These questions are taken up in a book by F. Leron Schultz called Science and Christology to some extent, but we still have a lot of work to do in this area. I think we can't disregard the place of human consciousness in the understanding of personhood today and many other aspects of things. I think what I want to say from my perspective is that while the evolutionary nature of personhood is complex, we can say that love comes to explicit consciousness in a way that belongs entirely and original to the person Jesus of Nazareth. There is something that emerges, almost explodes in this person of Jesus that is sui generis. And it sets him apart, you know, from everyone else. He is recognized as the Christ, as, you know, God, the Messiah, as God's loving plan for creation. He is the cosmic person, you might say, the paradigm of relationality. Jesus appears not simply as the perfect, you know, union of divine and human. You know, he doesn't pop on the screen and like say, okay, I'm the perfect subsistent union of divine and human natures. He emerges like every human person on the edge of a cataclysmic, violent, you know, cosmos that eventually gives rise to biological life on the edge of chaos. So in Jesus, a new consciousness of love becomes radically expressed in a way that departs from the Hebraic consciousness. This new religious consciousness is a new way of action. We can say that in Jesus there is sort of a new Big Bang. He's sort of a new singularity. The Gospels open with the word metanoia, you know, change, turn around. You're going in the wrong direction. A repentance, a summons to a new change of life, not only for the individual, but for the community, for the whole. This change is not just a, you know, just change today, but it means a new orientation of life. Christianity emerges out of older concepts of order, but it is more dynamic. From the beginning, it's more dynamic and modern than the classical hierarchical pyramid of God, human, and plant and animal life. The new Christian order that you might say emerges in Jesus is not about fixity of place. And it's not about hierarchy, it's about inclusiveness. Inclusiveness within the whole. His intimate experience of God empowered Jesus to act in the name of love, healing, reconciling all that is unloved in human persons. Jesus gathers what is scattered. He does the unthinkable. He eats with sinners. He reaches out across boundaries to, you know, Samaritan women, to the Gentiles, to tax collectors. Coming in taxis. And so, you know, for Jesus, sin, you might say, is living in that exile of unrelatedness. And he doesn't focus on the sin. He seeks to reconcile the unrelated, to bring them into relationship. And so his emphasis is on wholeness. Jesus' God-centered life shows a way of relating to others that makes holes where there are divisions. And we might say his love is a love that gathers and heals what is scattered and apart. And he asks that we make the choice for love that in a way that is, you know, in following his way, a love that will be more of a whole-making love. In this way, I think Jesus emphasizes the priority of human values over conventionally religious ones. He preached against religious alienation and challenged abstract religious laws. For example, he said the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. He constantly opted for the human person against the claims of legalistic religion. And I think that's what we see throughout the New Testament, the contrast between mere interior religiosity that is fixed to laws and abstract ideas with the love that makes whole, uniting humans to humans and humans to God. And so I think we see that in Jesus, God gives himself to us without reservation, becoming one of us. And so I speak of Jesus ushering in a new way of Catholicity. And I say that because the word Catholic, I think, has been too made too abstract as this type of universality. The word in its Greek root means kataholos, according to the whole. And I think, you know, that Catholicity is as a way of orienting oneself towards the whole. In other words, our task is to be homemakers and to love in a way that makes wholes. And in a sense, that's what Jesus did. He gathered together what was divided and confronted systems that diminished, marginalized, or excluded human persons. Because I realize the time here, so I want to just say, how did Teilhard take what emerged in Jesus as a new way of being, you might say, in relationship to God and to humanity, is that Teilhard saw that evolution is not just a mechanical or a physical process of biological life, but he said something more is going on here. And that something more, he said, is that it's not just something, he said, but it's someone who is coming to birth at the heart of evolution. The term he used is Christogenesis, that evolution from the point of Christian faith is the birth of the cosmic person or the birth of the Christ. In this way, Christianity, you might say, doesn't begin with Jesus alone, but it begins with Big Bang evolution. In other words, the whole of evolutionary time is that preparation that emerges in Jesus, but what emerges in Jesus now is continuing. As St. Paul said, we make up in our bodies what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. So we are part and parcel, you might say, of the Christ mystery. And what Teilhard said is that what makes this evolution of the Christ possible is that God is at the heart of evolution. God is that omega, the evolving power of evolution, and at the same time, the goal. That this evolutionary process has meaning and it has purpose in the Christ. So, again, from the point of the physical sciences, we can say that, you know, the process of evolution is a physical process. From the point of faith, it's the process of Christogenesis, or the coming to be of Christ, which means that that evolution is not mere chance or just random processes. It involves change. It involves becoming. It involves pattern process. And Christ, you might say, is that centrating principle. The one who was within is the one, you might say, who is before us. A universe in the process of Christification is a personalizing universe by which the consciousness of God and the consciousness of love become increasingly one. Teilhard saw a particular role for Christianity in evolution. It means that the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ is, you might say, what we are about in this evolutionary process. We are not just here randomly going to heaven, rather that what we are about is to continue what emerged in Jesus toward its fullness, toward Omega. God is not so much behind this evolutionary process as its creator, but God is in front of us as the lore, as the future. In Jesus, that future has, you might say, broken in. It has arrived, and we see in Jesus what we are, you might say, what we hope for, what we are destined for. God, in this sense, is the name of love's excess, which gives rise to being and transcends being. God is always the more of what any finite being can express. So God emerges from within in Jesus as ever newness in love, but at the same time is the future of every new love. And so I think, you know, what I want to emphasize is that the name God does not connote static being. The name God connotes the dynamism of love, a love that empowers this evolution, that breaks through in the person of Jesus, and that continues in our life as we continue in this evolutionary process. So what happens in Jesus, you might say, is what we anticipate for humanity in the cosmos itself. Not annihilation, but radical transformation in the power of God's self-giving spirit. The world is an evolving community in which self-identity is found less in oneself than in one's ongoing relation with others. We are to be community builders and whole makers, in a sense, in the building up of that cosmic wholeness. Christianity is the religion of cosmic personalization because it is a religion of love, which is not centered on the individual alone, but on the collective whole, the community. Christ is the cosmic person. And that's, I think, what we see in Jesus. Why he is recognized as the Christ is because what emerges in him is, you might say, that cosmic person, that communal wholeness. Teilhard posited a dynamic view of God in the world, of the process of becoming something more than what it is, because the universe is grounded in the personal center of Christ. So what Teilhard said is that we are the arrow of this evolutionary process. Our lives are intertwined in the mystery of Christ, which means our choices, our decisions, as you might say, Christ bearers, will impact the future. Teilhard spoke of the human person as a co-creator, and by that he meant we are not passing through this world like on a stormy ship, you know, ship on a stormy sea. Again, we are created to create. We are created to evolve into a new future. The choices we make in love and for love will co-create our future. So I speak of Christian evolution as thinking and seeing in a new way. I think the Christian is one who is connected through the heart to the whole of life, attuned to the deeper intelligence of nature, and called forth irresistibly by the Spirit to creatively express one's gifts in the evolution of self and world. Jesus brought into being through community, Jesus is brought into being through community and participates in the co-creation of it. We are to live on the cusp of an evolutionary breakthrough, and this means our conscious participation as co-creative agents of love. I think this is what it means to be Christ anew. Conscious, co-creative agents of love. To penetrate the truth of the Christ mystery within ourselves, in other persons, and in non-human creatures as well. To live the mystery of Christ is to live in the freedom of the Spirit, recognizing the connectedness that is a basic reality of our existence. We are always becoming part of a greater whole, trusting that God continues to create in and through us. Teilhard urged Christians to participate in this Christogenesis, to risk, get involved, aim towards union with others. He lamented the fact that Christianity had become stale, fixed, out of touch. He said, "We are not only to recognize evolution, but to continue it in ourselves." He says, "The role of the Christian is to divinize the world in Jesus Christ, to Christify the world, and by that, Christification means unification in love." That's how I understand it. Through our actions, through immersing ourselves in the world. He called this a mysticism of action. He said before, the Christian thought that she or he could attain God by abandoning everything, the fuga mundi. But now, he says, we realize we cannot be saved except through the universe and as a continuation of the universe. We cannot be saved except through the universe. Or as Teilhard wrote, we must make our way to heaven through earth. So in this respect, Christianity is the power of gathering into community what is yet unrelated or unloved. It is a religion of evolution. And in fact, there's a way, I think, of reading the Gospels through the lens of evolution, where we would see the whole of the gospel message is forward-looking. It is not backward-looking. Jesus constantly says, you know, if you put your hand to the plow, don't look back. Let the dead bury the dead. Your job is to follow me. The whole thing is moving forward to more being and more being in love. In this respect, we must work together to harness the energies of love for this forward movement of evolution. At the same time, I think we must renounce the idea that each individual person contains the ultimate value of one's existence and realize that our purpose consists in serving the continuation of evolution in the universe. Teilhard wrote, we must advance all together in a direction in which all together we can join and find completion in a spiritual renovation of the earth, what he called cosmic personalization. Christian evolution means that what began in Jesus must advance toward Omega, that fullness of Christ. We are all flowing in a stream of love, of divine love, but only when we become conscious of this stream and act from the center of consciousness will Omega, God all in all, be realized. Thank you.
Dr. Delio, is there a Trinitarian dimension to what you've just spoken about, and can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mickey. Yeah, there is a Trinitarian dimension. In fact, I actually explain this a little bit more in my book, The Unbearable Wholeness of Being, but I see the unfolding of Christ as, you might say, a whole trinitization of, you might say, evolution, that it's what we call Father or fountain fullness of love, you might say, pouring out into Word and Spirit. So that you can't have this kind of Christification of the universe as some exclusive. I see Trinity and Christ intimately linked with one another. That to talk about the Christogenesis of the universe is to talk about the work of the Trinity in evolution itself.
Yeah. Thank you.
Not only am I a 73-year-old student of theology, I have everything in English that Teilhard ever wrote.
Oh, yeah.
And there are three things in his inexhaustible genius, all right? One, he was a paleontologist. Two, he was a Jesuit priest. And three, he was a French aristocrat. And he has suffered denial in the Society of Jesus. In the 1920s, he wrote an essay for Internal Distribution questioning monogenesis. He said, look, biologically, there can't be an Adam and Eve, and he was exiled to China for 26 years. But he there, basically, was the man of action. He did it. And during the Second World War, he had a series of weekly discussions, and they're printed by Villanova Press, with a Franciscan who explained Duns Scotus to him.
Yes.
And it was this Franciscan who translated the entire Bible into Mandarin Chinese, who patiently explained the salvific rule of Christ. But the difficulty with Teilhard, even today, and the big mistake of the Jesuits, is silencing him and surrendering the copyright. If they kept the copyright, the church would be affluent today, okay? Because he's a major world seller. And my point is simply this. While he was defended by Henri de Lubac in two books, while Benedict called the great vision of Teilhard, he himself once said that his problem was the Mediterranean influences of the church. Newman said the church will never be universal as long as there's an Italian pope. And that was true. The point is, until they recognize the inexhaustible genius of this man and start dealing with the doctrinal consequences, this is the great shame of the church, because there is nobody of the stature of Teilhard in the last three centuries. And that's just my view. I just wonder what your reaction is.
Well, I just happen to be working on a book, unless you know. No, great, absolutely. So you have a lot there. Let me just see if I can sort a few things out. Yes, he was a Jesuit exiled to China because he could not accept, it was impossible to accept the doctrine of original sin as articulated in the church, in the church's official teaching. It doesn't make sense within the context of biological evolution. And so, you know, he just said, he didn't reject sin. So he has an understanding of sin and evil. So he will say that, you know, the doctrine of original sin was conceived to explain evil in you know, evil in the universe. So now we can understand, you might say, evil from the point of evolution itself. In other words, it's a finite contingent world that's in the process of becoming. So original sin goes hand in hand with a closed, fixed, static universe. Those things go together. It is not it's not a fixed, stable, static way of life. Now we know it's open and dynamic. It's an unfinished process that we are still in the process of being created. I think Mike Scanlon spoke to this. In any event, Teilhard did see himself in the line of the Greek fathers. He says this at one point. He realized, he recognized the import of his own work. The great watershed, I think, for Catholic doctrine is evolution. In other words, it's the great divide. Because once we accept evolution, then it's like the pin comes out of all the core doctrines. Then you have to reconceive every single one of them. What do we mean by salvation? What do we mean by redemption? You know, what is the doctrine of creation? All of those things get revisited. That is not a bad thing to do. I do think, but what Teilhard was saying is, we now know our world to be this. You know, evolution is not a theory. This is how life unfolds. So if we're going to continue holding on to this theology in this universe, theology now becomes abstract, conceptual. It loses its real living power. And I do think, on one hand, we have fallen into the land of the abstract concept. We have lost sight of the livingness of God. We're talking about a living God. And so God is at home in a world of chaos and change, because God is the God of this evolution. That's what we're saying. So so Teilhard really sought to try to explain over and over again as his superiors, and then, you know, the Pope, you know, said, absolutely not. Now, we know that during his lifetime, he was not allowed to publish anything of his spiritual writings, which means none of his writings were subject to critical evaluation. He couldn't revisit them. He couldn't hone his ideas. We only have as he thought through these things. I would agree. I think he's one of the great church fathers of the modern age. We do have a collection of works coming out of Woodstock is called Into the Future from Teilhard to Omega. And the idea of the project is to build on what Teilhard left us, to take off where Teilhard left off, you might say. So I think what you, I agree with all your comments on Teilhard. And just a P.S., a few years ago, we had the archives of Teilhard at Woodstock Theological Center, and the program manager came to me with two big boxes, and he said, "These have been sitting in my office for 10 years. Do you want them?" And I said, "Well, what are they?" And he said, "I don't know. I think they're the notes of Teilhard." So I opened them up, and sure enough, they were two boxes of Teilhard's notes from 1945 to 1955. What's so amazing about them is the way he was reading all the time, thinking all the time. It, his thought, his prayer, his life are just wrapped up in the way he was thinking through these mysteries. You know, and it was he was grappling with things all the time. And it's just amazing to see how someone of his stature worked through the divine, you know, the divine at work in our lives.
You still have them?
I do, yes. I'll take them with me, too. Other questions? Yes, Eileen.
It goes into what you just said. So what do we do with church dogma that we have to believe that is stuck in the old static worldview, like the Immaculate Conception, things like
well,
that.
We continue to work. In other words, like a day like today is exactly what we do. We come together, we grapple with the mysteries. We hear, you know, we hear from the history of theology. We hear what how theologians are thinking. We hear of what science has to tell us now about this universe we live. This is the mysticism of action that Teilhard pointed to. We must engage. If we're expecting the church to come up with some grand plan, you know, and then bestow it on us, we'll be dead, really. We are, in other words, we are the arrow of evolution. We are the arrow of Christogenesis. We are the arrow of the church itself. Our participation is what will make Christ alive in this universe and into the more full, you know, the greater fullness of being that's the up ahead or not. But don't. What Teilhard would say is, don't be passive. Wake up.
So
engage.
Are you saying don't be caught in the dogma?
No, don't get hung up. I mean, you know, every age has you know had to work through these things. What we are not to do is to get static and fixed, and to become fixed in the past. What Teilhard would say is, wake up to the present. Live in the present moment. You know, because this is the world that God is not has created. This is the world that God is creating. And God is creating this world in and through us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.